5th, 2011. Welcome everyone who's here in attendance on this very first afternoon meeting of this session coming up. I guess maybe I'll just start a little bit with a couple of comments on my own behalf as chair of this committee. It is my intent that we will start these committee meetings promptly at 1 o'clock, just so everyone knows. When you're a old-time radio guy, you know that minutes mean money. And we're here to be of service to the citizens of this state, so you will hear that gavel drop either by myself or my vice chair over here, Senator Daley, promptly at 1 o'clock. We've already talked to our members, and they're going to be courteous and let us know if for some reason they can't make it promptly at that time so that we're well aware. But we're going to start on time, and we're going to move along. We've been allotted an hour and a half for our committee meetings. If we get into the situation where we have to have a little extra time, we can add up to a half an hour. But my intent today here is to go from now until 2:30. I know we have a dynamic presentation towards the end, not to say that we're not going to have a couple of good dynamic ones here early on, but we are going to end the meeting at 2:30, and if we still have some other questions for Peter Hutchinson at that time, we'll let those members go because I want to be courteous of their time and other committees as well. I think what I'd like to do right now, if I can, is just say this is all about redesign and innovation, and that's what we're going to do with this committee in this session. We are going to look at the agencies that we have in this great state of ours, and we're going to find a better way to do what we do best, and that's what this committee is going to address and look at throughout its term. But before I do, I want to get started with introductions, and I think, is there somebody you want to flip a coin? Which side do we want to start? Let's start over here. We're going to start over on this side. I'm going to have each person just state their name, what their position is, and a little bit about their position and what they would like as we move forward. So let's start with Craig.
I'm Craig Sunday, a researcher with the Republican Caucus.
And I'm Tom Bodern. I'm the Senate Counsel for the State Government and Veterans Committee. I've been staffing that area for several years, since about 1996, I believe.
I'm Ted Daley, State Senator from Senate District 38, which is Eagan and the eastern part of Burnsville. And by training background, I'm a CPA and 22 years of active duty and Army Reserve experience with a couple of tours in Iraq and a tour in Israel, Guatemala, Korea, you know, lots of different places. But this isn't about me. I had the opportunity just a few minutes ago to meet a very special person, and I didn't plan this out. I just want to recognize Mike McElhenney for his 21 years of service and his special forces background. He served in Afghanistan, and if you go up to him and shake his hand, you'll notice that his right hand is a prosthesis. So he has given not just his time, but when we talk about sacrifice, here's sacrifice right here. So I would just want to recognize him. If you could stand up.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Julianne Ortman. I serve in the Senate from Carver and part of Scott County. I've not served on the State Government Committee before or Veterans Affairs, and it's truly an honor to do that. I'm a big fan of what our armed services do for us to protect us and to protect our freedoms. And so it's a great honor to serve on this committee with you, Chairman Perry, and to the other members. I appreciate your service as well.
Dave Thompson, I am in the Lakeville and Farmington area and have a number of the townships and smaller towns down south and east of Farmington. I, too, am honored to be here and have an opportunity to participate. I'm a freshman senator, and I'm very much looking forward to the experience.
I'm Paul Gazelka. I served in the House in 2005 and 2006, and this is my first term in the Senate. Chair Perry, this is a committee that I was wanted to be on. I think government innovation is critical at this hour. In addition to that, I represent the Brainerd Little Falls area, District 12, and Camp Ripley is right in the middle of that. And it's just a jewel for our state, and I want to make sure that we make it the best it can be as well.
All right, thank you. Let's start over here with you, Lucas.
My name's Lucas Nessie. I'll be the committee administrator for this committee. I've been with the Senate for over 5 years now, and I look forward to working with all of you.
I'm Elizabeth DeBeck. I'm Senator Perry's legislative assistant.
And I'm Kevin Lundeen, the fiscal analyst for the committee, and I've worked with the state government budget division for a number of years.
Hi, my name's Chuck Wieger. I represent Maplewood, North St. Paul, Oakdale. I'm in my fifth term. Prior to that, I served on a school board for nearly 18 years, chaired that. I also chaired the Ramsey Soil and Water Conservation District and was a member of the Metropolitan Council. So, yes, I'm very interested in the various levels of government and cooperation, shared service, innovative approaches, and hopefully that experience will be helpful. Additionally, I'm very committed to doing whatever we can to help our veterans. My dad was injured in World War II. I have a daughter that's back now from Iraq and serving as a social worker, and look forward to doing whatever we can to help these heroes.
Thank you, Senator.
My name is John Carlson. I represent Senate District 4, which runs just north of Paul Gazelka's district, the 371 corridor from Pequot Lakes up to Bemidji. I'm very interested in the Government Innovations Committee, especially Beltrami County is one of the, I think, might be the only county in the state of Minnesota that actually lowered its levy this last cycle, for the coming biennium. And Cass County had zero increase in their levy. And so there's some great innovation going on in outstate and greater Minnesota, and hopefully we can bring some of those ideas down to the state level.
Well, we look forward to it. Senator?
Chair Perry, thank you very much. My name is Ted Lilly, and I'm from Senate District 56, which are 11 communities in central Washington County, from Woodbury to Stillwater, and a number of the communities in between there. I'm honored to serve on this committee. In this economic situation, our families are being very innovative in how they are providing for themselves. Our job creators are being innovative in how they are providing for themselves. And we as a government need to find ways to be more innovative in what we do to provide our services to our constituents also. And our veterans are serving us so well, and this committee is a very important one, and I am honored to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you. Barb Goodwin, it's my first term in the Senate. I served 3 terms in the Minnesota House and also worked 10 years in the Minnesota Majority, Director of Majority Research, Media and Constituent Services in the House. I represent District 50, which is Arden Hills, Shoreview, New Brighton, Columbia Heights, Fridley, Hilltop, and St. Anthony, and represented half of that district as a state representative for 6 years. I am interested in state government finance. I have worked as legislative affairs director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees as well, interested in how government can provide better services how we can make sure that people understand the services that government provides and the importance to the public of those services. I'm also interested in veterans affairs and hope to be able to add as much as I can from my experience to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Senator Dibble, you want to do a short introduction for everyone here?
Well, Barb was so thorough. I didn't know if I could be that thorough on the fly here. But my name is Scott Dibble, state senator from Southwest Minneapolis District 60. So I represent all of the neighborhoods around the Chain of Lakes, Isles, Calhoun, Cedar, and Harriet, and then the southern half of downtown Minneapolis as well. I'm starting my third term in the Senate. I served 1 term in the House. As a matter of fact, Senator Goodwin and I were freshman colleagues back in 2000. Currently serve on the Transportation Committee and the this committee and I'm forgetting my third three committees, Energy Committee. In the past, I've served on taxes and economic development and continue to maintain a keen interest in those subjects as well. Looking forward to my service with you, Senator Perry, looking at state government and veterans affairs and looking for opportunities for streamlining and innovation. I like the name of the committee. It's great. looking forward to figuring out how we can do the best. And I have a lot of ideas, and actually started working on some of those ideas as a freshman in the House and in the minority at that time. Didn't get too far, so I'm looking to renew them because it seems to be more fashionable now to talk about how we streamline, gain greater efficiency, and serve people better with the dollars that we have available to us.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Senator Coleman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I'm just reviewing the policy, which is a good idea because I'm habitually late. And, and so now I'm going to correct. I apologize. I got caught up with a phone call with my office because this is the first day. I've got to kind of figure out how things work because it used to be I'd have a break during committees. I'd just go across the hall to my office. I was debating should I go over the state office building or not. And so I apologize. But I'm Dick Cohen, represent District 64, southwestern part of St. Paul, and looking forward to being on this committee. Obviously, the jurisdictions have changed with the combination of policy and finance, but chaired the state government finance division. That was my first finance chairmanship. At that time, the jurisdictions were about three times what I think they are here, about twice what they are here. But that was my original chairmanship, so looking forward to revisiting many of these same issues.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray,
thank you.
Want to give us a little introduction?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm sorry I'm late. I guess it's a new day, and you guys are all on time. This is very good. My previous committee was on time, too, so thank you so much for that. I represent District 62, which is southeast Minneapolis. This is my second term, and I'm happy to be back.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for the introductions this afternoon, and it's good to have everyone here. I'm excited about where we're going to go. And Senator Cohen, I just want to say thanks for right out of the chute, you and Senator Wigger coming forth and saying, hey, we've got some great ideas that hopefully we can work together on and move forward. So I'm looking forward to that. As I mentioned earlier, it's about innovation and redesign, open-mindedness, as we move forward with this committee and those that will be in front of us. So I'd like to move on here just for the senators here, just so you know, inside your packet, there's, as Senator Cohen said, some attendance items that I'd just like to have you take a look at and then get back to me here. It's nothing that we really have to do here today. Just a couple of housekeeping issues that I would like to bring forward. It's okay that we have beverages on the table, but if we're going to do any eating, I'd appreciate that on the backside. And I know how that gets sometimes when you're running from one place to another, but let's keep the food off the table here, and but the beverages are okay. Just another housekeeping item that remember, if you have any lobbyists or folks that want to talk to you, rather than to disrupt the committee, I would like to have you leave the table, and I think most of the senior senators do that anyway, but your LA, that's fine if they want to come up and speak with you while you're at the table, but any kind of lobbyist or citizens that want to talk to you, please step away from the table. And then there is one other issue that you know, I hear it every Sunday when I go to church. I think it's one of the first things out of my pastor's mouth is we all live in this high-tech world, and we have cell phones, and we have all of those gadgets. Please keep them on vibrate. Our intent here is to keep this meeting to 90 minutes, and I would hope that you have people that will watch any phone calls coming into you, but if you do have to leave, feel free, but let's keep those things on vibrate so we don't interrupt any testimony or any people appearing. So those are just a couple of housekeeping items. We're going to move on here and take a look at the overview of the committee's jurisdiction for you, and I think it would be best, rather than to, in the radio world, we call it ad-libbing, that I'm just going to read straight forward a statement here on the overview of the committee's jurisdiction. The Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans Budget and Policy has jurisdiction over all legislation creating a new state agency, changing the organization of a current state agency, and transferring duties between existing state agencies. The committee will also vet legislation relating to state administrative services, state administrative procedures, state employee compensation, labor relations, pensions and retirement, gambling, lotteries, and the legislature. It is also responsible for veterans and military affairs. And, of course, that leads me to moving forward and asking both Kevin Lundeen, fiscal analyst, and Tom Bodern, our state counsel. Each has a presentation, and I think, Tom, were you going to start first? We're going to let Tom start first, and we'll hear from Tom and then Kevin, and then after that, I'm sure Mr. Hutchinson will be here. So, Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll use the table here and spread things out a little bit. I won't inflict a PowerPoint on you, but I will call your attention to a document that's in the packet. Well, Senator Perry was just reading from it, but you will find it in there. A word about the source for this document. This is an excerpt from the committee jurisdictions list that is, I think, nearly final. There may be a few changes that are necessary to make to it, but in its substance, I think it can be represented as complete. The document, a couple of things I would point out. I think the State Government Committee is jurisdiction is somewhat unusual. There are other committees where it's much more intuitive, like the Transportation Committee. It's pretty obvious which bills are going to go there. The temptation is to think of the State Government Committee as kind of a catch-all when you look through this list for a lot of miscellaneous boards, commissions, and so forth. But when you look at it, obviously, there's the veterans component. That's straightforward. But the core of the jurisdiction is what I would call the state government service agencies, internal service agencies in particular. An example of that would be the Department of Administration, which primarily provides services to other agencies, procurement, plant management, that sort of thing, that enable other agencies to operate and perform their mission. When you take a look at the narrative that appears at the top of the document, there are a couple of items that are also somewhat unique to the State Government Committee. Any legislation creating a new state agency would have to be heard eventually in the State Government Committee, not necessarily as the committee of first reference, but it will eventually make its way to the committee. Changing the organization of a state agency is obviously open to interpretation somewhat, but those bills do emerge from time to time and are clearly related to as the chairman's interest in innovating. Related to that is the transfer of duties between agencies. And a note on that, the governor does have the authority to transfer independently some functions between agencies. He's got to do that through a reorganization order, and those committees are also, those orders are also under the jurisdiction of this committee. Once the governor issues an order and reorganizes agencies, he's then required to prepare legislation that would finalize that and accomplish that, and that legislation would make its way to this committee. So going through the list of individual agencies and beginning at the top, you can see the constitutional officers. I won't go into a great deal of comment there. I think most of their functions are self-evident. I will point out that because they're constitutional, the ability to affect them with legislation is somewhat more limited. Traditionally, the budget committee takes some involvement in setting the budget, but the level of involvement in the changes to these entities is obviously more limited. And the state auditor, I think it's worth noting here because often there is confusion, deals with primarily local governments. The legislative auditor performs a separate function that is also under the jurisdiction of this committee. The committee also has jurisdiction over bills that would affect the legislature. For example, a bill establishing a new legislative commission, bills affecting the number of members in the legislature would be another example of a bill that would fall under this committee's jurisdiction. Then at the going into the list of agencies, I'll try to give you a thumbnail description of what these agencies, boards, commissions do. It's going to be very brief. And I know there are a number of folks in the audience here from some of these agencies. If I miss something, please accept my apologies in advance. The Department of Military Affairs is what most people think of as the National Guard. And this committee will handle the appropriations that represent the state portion of funding for the Guard. and some of the policy related to that. The Department of Veterans Affairs handles, and this is one area that's fairly easy to confuse with some of the federal government functions, but the State Department of Veterans Affairs provides assistance to veterans, both financial and in terms of coordinating access to federal benefits, and also now has jurisdiction included within that department are veterans' homes. That was previously a separate entity, and now it's one of the major responsibilities in that department. The Department of Revenue appears on the list, and what I'll call your attention to there is obviously tax policy is set elsewhere, but you could think of this committee's jurisdiction as the management of that department, personnel, who they're hiring, what the budget is, how they're functioning effectively. Then one of the core internal service agencies that I mentioned previously, the Department of Administration, a brief look at some of the functions that department performs I think is helpful. That would include risk management, the state's insurance, or self-insurance, I should say, procurement policies, how the goods and services the state uses are procured, what the bidding policies are, and so forth, plant management, all of the various buildings owned by the state and the policies and funding required to accomplish that. Related to that would be capital improvements, how bonds, well, how the bonds are let would be up to the Department of Management and Budget, but just the process of acquiring capital improvements and then managing them. Travel management is another example of an Department of Administration function, including the state's vehicle fleet. Next on the list is the Department of Management and Budget. Again, this is similar to the Department of Revenue. What's being dealt with here is how that department is administered and not the policy for the state budget. The Department of Management and Budget also includes what used to be known as the Department of Employee Relations, which is, again, another key internal service function, how state employees are hired, terminated. The labor agreements they are subject to are negotiated now by the Department of Management and Budget. Next up is the first item we see on the list that's related to the gambling component of this committee's jurisdiction, the alcohol and gambling enforcement of the Department of Public Safety. And describing that in a nutshell, I think that would be the enforcement of illegal gambling laws in Minnesota. Some of the work they perform might be related to some of the gambling control board concerns on perhaps equipment, things like that. The Office of Administrative Hearings is next on the list, and it's closely related to another major area under this committee's jurisdiction, which is rulemaking. Chapter 14 in the state statutes describes the process agencies need to go through in order to adopt rules. Any changes to that process are under the jurisdiction of this committee. The Office of Administrative Hearings is closely involved in the rulemaking process, reviewing the work that the agencies do before they can adopt a rule. It has a couple of other functions, including administrative hearings. Some specific statutes will make use of an administrative hearing component in order to bypass use of the trial courts. And the Office of Administrative Hearings also handles unfair campaign practices complaints. That's a relatively new function. Next, you see the Public Facilities Authority, which I believe is housed, it's relatively new to the State Government Committee jurisdiction. That's housed in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Primarily what they're handling is municipal wastewater treatment funding. Then another core agency for providing internal state services, the Office of Enterprise Technology, which is both setting the policy for and handling the acquisition of information technology for the state. Another vital function they have, of course, is the information technology security policies and enforcement. The Environmental Quality Board is housed within the Department of Administration, and I think its primary function would be environmental review rulemaking. Then we hit some of the kind of the wider variety of boards and commissions. I'll try to move relatively quickly through those, trying to manage time here. I should have said, if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me as I'm going along here. There'll certainly be time for them later, I think. The Board of the Arts handles grant making. It's using a variety of funding sources for various arts-related projects. The Capital Area and Architecture Planning Board, often just called the CAP Board, can be thought of as kind of a zoning and planning authority for the Capital Area, which includes not just the Capital, but I don't know the exact parameters of the boundaries, but basically the area on the hill here. The Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board jurisdiction in this committee is limited to the budget. The policy related to campaign finance will be handled in the Local Government Elections Committee. The Designer Selection Board is used in the state building project process for any project over $200,000. This group selects the specific designer responsible for that project. The Gambling Control Board, I touched on earlier, primarily handles pull tabs and bingo and other forms of legalized gambling in the state. They've, in addition to kind of an educational mission, they handle the enforcement related to those items. The State Board of Investment, as you see, is a constitutional entity. It's composed of the governor, the state auditor, and the secretary of state, and they oversee the investment of all state funds, including the pension funds. The Amateur Sports Commission, I think most people would connect that with the National Sports Center in Blaine. They also handle a variety of grants to local units of government for various amateur sports facilities and projects. Then there are a couple of legislative commissions. I will move fairly quickly through those. The one I would call to your attention is the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Many of you are very familiar with that. They handle the pension legislation. Most pension bills would go through this committee and kind of informally be referred to that commission to make a recommendation on how to proceed with that. That's a House and Senate, a group of members from both the House and Senate. And typically, in the past, they prepare an omnibus bill that deals with most of the pension issues. The Racing Commission that you see next is part of the gambling jurisdiction in this committee. They handle the regulation of horse racing and the card playing at those horse racing facilities. The Regional Development Commissions that you see on here,
Mr.
I think
Chair?
There's one item that may need to be resolved. That's
excuse me, Mr. Brennan. Senator Wigger?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay to ask questions
sure.
since
Go
I
ahead.
Was invited, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodern. Amateur Sports Commission, is there also any jurisdiction on sports facilities?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wigger, are you referring to ice hockey arenas, things? I'm not sure what
you
might have in mind.
Mr. Chair, the, you know, with the dome?
Oh, I think you're thinking of the Metropolitan right. Sports Facilities Commission. And that would be under the, because it's a local government entity, is under the jurisdiction of Senator Vandeveer's committee. Mm-hmm. Sorry, a little slow on tracking you there.
Mr. Chair, one other.
Go ahead, Senator Wigger.
Not related. Since we have the Commission on Metropolitan Government listed, mm-hmm. is there anything regarding Metro Council that this committee has an appetite for? I believe there's an AG opinion that actually said the council was quasi-state. But I might ask that of the chair as well. But
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wigger, again, I apologize. I think there's a little bit of confusion, and I think we've made our way through most of that. The local government items that were previously under this committee's jurisdiction that are now under the jurisdiction of the Local Government Elections Committee, I think would include possibly that the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, which basically just has its function is the oversight of the Metropolitan Council.
Right.
I'm not familiar with any work that it's done recently.
Okay.
Moving on.
Mr. Bonner, mm-hmm. could I have you take a rest and a deep breath just for a moment? Senator Olson just showed up because she had a previous commitment, but we've all introduced ourselves, and I wanted to give you a quick opportunity to do an introduction so that everybody knew who was sitting on the committee, even some of the new senators.
Well, thank you. I apologize, but New LA did not have access to my computer messages, so I didn't know about it until the meeting, until just a short while ago, and was working on my own committee. Jen Olson, State Senator, District 33. Been around a long time, the longest of the Republican members of the Senate. Senate District 33 is Western Hennepin County, and I have the interesting opportunity to serve 20 of the 44 cities that are in Hennepin County that are represented by 15 senators. So I have an interesting conglomeration of governmental units, and I'm looking forward also to the working on innovation and what we can do in terms of making state government run more effectively as well.
All right. Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Bodden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I'm moving rather rapidly here. I just want to manage the time and make my way through the list, but I do welcome questions. So I think I'm at the very bottom of the first page of the list. The Humanities Center is a nonprofit organization that handles grants for humanities education. Then if you look at the top of page 2, there are several items that are related to the veterans jurisdiction. The Armory Building Commission does just that. I haven't seen a whole lot of recent activity related to that, possibly because I don't think there have been too many armories constructed recently, but I know there are folks in the room that could give you more detail on that if you wanted that. Veterans Homes, I touched on previously. Then there's a group of three private organizations that do work with veterans that are listed here. They are, I believe, recognized in statute, which is one of the reasons they're listed here. There are several grants that have been made in the previous appropriations bills to a variety of private organizations that work with veterans, and these groups certainly have received those and do on a continuing basis. Next up, in the next group of councils, there are actually four councils. You'll see the Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Council on Black Minnesotans, and the Council on the Affairs of Chicano Latino People, as well as at the bottom of that small group there, the Indian Affairs Council. As the name suggests, each of these councils deals with the affairs of these minority groups within the state, and they were created at various times. I think the Indian Affairs Council was first. They are their membership includes legislators. I'll point that out. And their primary function, when you look at the statutes, is to serve as a clearinghouse for ideas to be presented to the legislature. A number of them handle some other functions as well. Next up is the Compensation Council. This is a group of appointees from and members of each of the three branches of government, from the judicial, the executive, and the legislative branches. They meet once every 2 years, and they prepare a list of recommendations for compensation for legislators, constitutional officers, agency heads, and I believe a cap on salaries for local government employees. Typically, they prepare a report, and then the legislature reviews that and makes whatever use of that report it sees fit. The Executive Council is primarily responsible for selecting depositories for state funds. It does have some emergency powers. It includes the governor and, I believe, some of the other constitutional officers. The Governor's Residence Council is housed within, it's taken care of through the Department of Administration and handles some of the issues related to the work that needs to be done on the governor's residence, I think intended to make that possibly place it in more of a nonpartisan setting to remove any concerns about that. Next up, you'll see the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council kind of standing on its own there. That's a component of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The name is self-explanatory. They handle the promotion of tourism in Minnesota. The tort claims component that you see listed here relates to the state's policy on sovereign immunity. Without going into a great detail about it, it's the policy regarding the exemptions or the limits that the state imposes on its own tort immunity. Obviously, the most famous example of that recently would be the 35W bridge collapse. Contingent accounts are just that. They're amounts set aside to deal with events that may arise during the interim when the legislature is not in session. The Historical Society and the Science Museum, I don't think, need a great deal of explanation or comment. Then you'll see the retirement associations and the Minnesota State Retirement System group together here. Those are also self-explanatory. I will point out there are a variety of other. There's the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association and I think a few others that are included within the pension bill. I won't list them for you here, and that's typically has been handled through an omnibus bill that comes from the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Then we come to the confirmations. I'll point out there that the committee will have 60 legislative days to act upon confirmations once the appointment letters from the governor have been received. And that's the way the Senate rules are currently written. Obviously, that could be subject to change, but that's been the practice in recent sessions. And at the end of that 60-day period, if action hasn't been taken, then those appointments are referred to the entire Senate for action on the confirmation calendar. And you can see the variety of individuals who are subject to Senate confirmation here. There is a short listing of other laws at the bottom of the second page. The Administrative Procedure Act, as I mentioned earlier, is rulemaking. Most of these are self-explanatory. I'll point out that the Public Employment Labor Relations Act sets the policy for state public employment unions. Finally, there's a page that deals with the re-referral jurisdiction of this committee. And you'll see this is taken from the temporary Senate rules as they were adopted yesterday. And it's just an excerpt from Rule 4. Section 4.5 requires that any bill that delegates rulemaking or that exempts an agency from rulemaking must be heard by the committee before it can be passed. And typically that's handled through a re-referral. And Section 4.6 is another aspect of the committee's jurisdiction. If there's a bill creating any form of new group, whether it's a commission, council, task force, board, et cetera, then that includes a member of the legislature, it must also be re-referred to the committee before final passage or before it's placed on general orders, excuse me. And I will point out there the temptation is to think of some other name to call the group. That doesn't work. The rule applies in any event. That's what I have for you. I'd welcome questions. I know Mr. Lundin has a fair amount to present to you as well.
Quickly, are there any, Mr. Bodern, are there any new agencies that have fallen under this new structure under state government?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's the gambling component. I suppose that was under the jurisdiction of the committee last session. The major ones I'd point out would be the Public Facilities Authority, which is part of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I think related to that, the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council.
All right. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I assume Mr. Lundin's going to talk about some of the nature of appropriations, so maybe I could just inquire in terms of jurisdictions. And I just a couple of quick questions, if I can. I like what generally what's been done with the jurisdictions, but because I think the streamlining is making some sense. But just so I understand that how things are handled, in terms of the policy end of the committee, hypothetical, you want to combine the Department of Revenue and Management and Budget. That would be within the jurisdiction of this committee in terms of both policy and fiscal. But let's say you wanted to do, I don't know, PCA and DNR. Would the policy then be done in this committee, but the finance end of it would be in the environment? Is that what's contemplated, or?
Mr. Botter, you want to help with that one?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, I think as far as the specific bill that would accomplish that, for example, the merger of the DNR and PCA, that bill would likely be referred first to the Environment Committee and then re-referred to this committee because of the state government implications involved in it.
Okay.
Once those changes are accomplished, the underlying agency would, in all likelihood, remain under the jurisdiction of the Environment Committee.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, we've kind of batted this back and forth over the years, but Department of Revenue. So I take it that's not within, in terms of the policy or fiscal, is that in the Tax Committee then?
It's here.
Did I miss that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, and this is the way that it's been handled in the past. It's, I think it's best to say it's the management of the Department of Revenue that would be under the jurisduction of this committee and
okay,
not
I'm,
tax
I,
policy.
And I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I missed that. So let me withdraw that. The other question I had was, and this might be really premature because it's more of maybe a conference committee issue, but with the so-called legacy amendment funding, is I take it this committee would have the financial jurisdiction over what's listed here that has been put in that amendment's jurisdiction. Is that true for conference committee purposes, or is that a little bit premature?
Senator Cohen, unless Mr. Bodern has an answer, I can't give you an answer on that. That's something, I mean, everything is new here, remember.
I'll ask a question about 3 months. How's that?
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that, Senator. Any other questions we might have for Mr. Bodern? Thank you, sir. That was very helpful, I'm sure, for everyone here at the table. And now let's move on. Mr. Lundeen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In your packets, you'll have a couple of documents there. There's one that's titled Appropriations and Agency Billing, and then you should have a three-page spreadsheet. I think what I'll start out with is the document titled Appropriations, and just kind of go over just a little review of the different type of appropriations there are and what we'll be dealing with in this committee. When we talk about appropriations, there's a couple of different types. There's the direct appropriations, the statutory appropriations. Primarily when we put the budget bill together, we'll be dealing with the direct appropriations. That shows up in the omnibus budget bill. We'll list an agency. We'll maybe have a rider explaining what the dollars are going for. And primarily it'll be from the general fund, but not entirely. And then when we move down to the statutory appropriations, and a lot of times these we maybe don't deal with so much. They're in statute. They're ongoing. Some examples of some of the statutory appropriations are like the campaign financing. That's a forecasted open appropriation from the general fund. We track that on the spreadsheet, but unless, you know, we decide we want to make a change in statute, that level of funding will just continue on. There's a couple other, when I talk about statutory appropriations, there's the open appropriations, like the campaign finance, which is a forecasted amount. And then there's also dedicated appropriations that show up. And these are usually tied to a revenue stream. An example of that would be there's a number of internal service funds in some of the agencies, like the Department of Administration, plant management. All the money that's being appropriated is statutorily appropriated. What money, you know, the Department of Administration takes in from the leases and so forth is given to the agency, and then they manage it and carry it out. So unless we made a change to one of those dedicated appropriations, that would just continue on and on. Another example of a dedicated appropriation in the Vets Affairs and Military Affairs area is the Support Our Troops license plate revenue. That money comes in and is directly appropriated in statute to the two departments to use for the purposes listed in statute. Other examples of some dedicated appropriations is one of the initiatives that was undertaken in the last biennium was an electronic licensing system, whereas a surcharge was put on business, occupational licenses, commercial licenses, and professional licenses, and this was to set up this licensing system for a number of state agencies within state government. And then also, maybe if I go back to the open appropriations again, I'll just touch on a few other examples there. The pension appropriations are open appropriations. Most of those are forecasted. There are a couple of exceptions. There are some appropriations where there is an amount listed in statute, such as the MRF appropriation. There is a dollar amount listed in statute for that. That goes to PERA to manage MRF. A couple other examples would be in management and budget. There's an appropriation for the new accounting system, which is called SWIFT, the Statewide Integrated Financial Tools. And there's an appropriation coming from the general fund that pays for that. And also for the integrated tax system in the Department of Revenue, there is a statutory appropriation that takes care of that. I think next what I'll do is I'll go to the spreadsheet and just kind of touch on some of the items there and maybe some of the different funds and stuff that are going on. I don't think I'll spend a lot of time on the agencies. I think Mr. Bodern kind of ran through some of the basics with the agencies. As you see, we have the appropriations for the legislature. And I should say on this spreadsheet, this is information taken from the consolidated fund balance. So that's covering all of the funds in state government. And I should note, in the consolidated fund balance, there are some items that don't show up in here. In particular, it's situations where an agency is paying another agency for a service. And I'll kind of go through some of those at the end, because there are a number of agencies that do provide services in this area that a major portion of their operating budget comes from agency billings. As you go down, we have the legislature and the Legislative Coordinating Commission and that. And as I said, this is a series of some of these funds are directly appropriated and some of them are statutorily appropriated. We have the governor's office. We have the general fund appropriation. One item I should point out, the special revenue fund there. I know in previous sessions there's been interest in that. And that was actually an agency billing out to the state agencies to pay for some of the staff in the governor's office and for the office in Washington, D.C. Moving down to the state auditor, largely general funded there, and a portion of the general fund in the state auditor's office is offset by revenue that comes in for the audit fees. We make the appropriation, and then the audit fees that are collected by the state auditor are a non-dedicated receipt to the general fund. Moving down to the Attorney General, the Attorney General's office is kind of funded partially with some direct appropriations and partially does some billing out to some of the larger agencies for the legal services. The next is the Secretary of State, and we provide the general fund appropriation there. That's both covers the business side and the election side of that agency. And I should point out, when you see a general fund transfer out, this is just not to double count money, and that it's a lot of times where some money general fund appropriation is made and it may be transferred into a special revenue fund or something else. So the reason those are showing as negative numbers is just not to double count. Then we move down to the Campaign Finance Board. That's a direct general fund appropriation. The special revenue fund, what that is that's the campaign financing money. That is originally a general fund appropriation. If you move down to the next line, line 44, you see the general fund money, and then it's transferred out, and it's transferred into the special revenue fund, and that's where the actual payments are made out. The next is the investment board. We make an appropriation there for the out of the general fund, the small portion, and that covers the amount that the investment board is doing regarding managing the general fund and the investing there. The special revenue fund, basically, they do a charge out to the other funds that they're managing, and that comes into their agency and then covers the operating costs of the agency. And that is a statutory appropriation. We are not making that appropriation in the budget bill. Moving down to administrative hearings, they have a couple of different funding going on there. They have the general fund appropriation, which basically covers the municipal boundary adjustment unit in the agency. The Workers' Compensation Special Fund covers the Workers' Comp Division of that agency. And then also not showing up here because it's an agency billing is the Administrative Law Division, which is run on a revolving fund, and they charge out fees and so forth. Going down next is the Office of Enterprise Technology. And I should point out with the Office of Enterprise Technology, that's another agency that does a lot of billing for its services out to other agencies. So if you're looking on here, you're thinking, well, it's only $10 million, $11 million general fund, but there's probably about 90% of the budget that is coming through the different billings that it's doing. What the general fund portion there is covering is the security for the state, and then there's also a couple million that's going for planning and so forth. The money in the special revenue is regarded to the e-licensing surcharge that I spoke about earlier. And then there's a small portion of federal fund coming in. Then there's the Department of Administration. They provide a lot of services to agencies, too. And so the general fund is probably, you know, representing a very small portion of their fund. And then the Special Revenue Fund, that is another statutory appropriation that's dealing with the workers' comp program, and they charge out to agencies. The costs are allocated and come into that fund. Taking a look at the next page, you have the Capital Area Architect Planning Board. We make a general fund appropriation there. The special revenue is also a dedicated fees that are coming into the agency. The next is Minnesota Management and Budget. We make the general fund appropriation there. And then the general fund transfer out, those dollars there are representing the money that's going to pay for the debt service on the SWIFT, which is the accounting and procurement replacement system. And then there's also a special revenue fund there that's showing up. Largely, a lot of that has to do with billings to agencies for the accounting and procurement system, paying some of the operating costs. The next item is a non-operating account in management and budget. And essentially what this is kind of a clearinghouse account. It's dollars that will kind of flow through there that don't naturally fit with another agency. An example of how that would be used would be with the dollars that came forward for the 35W bridge collapse. They went through the non-operating account of management and budget. The general fund dollars that are represented there in the transfer outs have to do with some reimbursements from the general fund that go to the DNR and public safety to reimburse those funds, Game and Fish Fund and State Patrol Fund and that in those agencies. And then on line 83 is the indirect costs, and this is a negative line that we track. And essentially what that represents is reimbursements to the general fund for services provided to other funds. And then moving down to the Department of Revenue, we're dealing with the operating budget of the department there. And generally we make the general fund appropriations. I should point out with the Department of Revenue, we have funded a number of tax compliance initiatives over the last several years. And so the general fund budget there has been increasing as we've been putting more money into compliance. And then the general fund transfer out, that's representing the integrated tax system, paying the debt service on that system. And then there's also appropriations that are made from the Healthcare Access Fund and the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund and the Environmental Fund. That's just to pay for the administration of the collection of those particular taxes.
Mr. Lundeen?
Yes.
We have about 7 minutes left. I see Mr. Hutchinson is here. If you want to highlight the others, and I'm sure if there's questions after the meeting today, all the committee members can get a hold of you. But just highlight here in the next 6 minutes, please.
Okay. I'll kind of run down pointing out anything. On line 99 with Veterans Affairs, you see we make a general fund appropriation, and then there's a large transfer out. That is going into a special revenue fund related to the vets' homes. As we look down, a lot of the councils and stuff, funding is fairly straightforward there. If you look on line 130 with both the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission, they are paid from special revenue funds from licensing and regulatory fees, and those are a direct appropriation rather than being a statutory appropriation. Turning to the next page, the Public Facilities Authority, largely that runs on a revolving fund, so there's a lot of dollars there that aren't necessarily showing up here on this particular sheet. And I think running down pretty much the rest of them are pretty straightforward. I did talk briefly about the pension funds. And I think the other thing I'll point out is we do have jurisdiction over the lottery, but basically what we do with the lottery is we put in a cap in the omnibus bill on their operating expenses, how much that they can can spend in a year, and that's generally somewhere around $27.7 million a year that comes out of the lottery dollars that are coming in. And I think lastly, I would just like to take a look at the other sheet that's called agency billing and just touch on that briefly. I did mention that there are a number of operating dollars in these agencies that don't show up on the spreadsheet that I was going through. They don't show up in the consolidated fund balance because they're billings to other agencies. And I think it's kind of good to just be aware of that. The Attorney General, about 24% of their budget or $17 million in the biennium. The Department of Administration, about $180 million in the biennium is coming in through the various services. Offices of Administrative Hearings, about $4.5 million is coming in for the administrative hearing portion of that office. Minnesota Management and Budget, I mean, there they've got a responsibility for the state employee benefit program, CGIP, which is the employee group insurance. That's about, and with a few other smaller things, that's about $1.7 billion in the biennium. The Office of Enterprise Technology, which I mentioned, about 90% of their budget is coming from billings. That's about $191 million. And then also the investment board that I did touch on earlier. So I think kind of in a nutshell, that's kind of what we have before us.
All right. Thank you very much. I think we'll leave it at that. I'm sure we can get you more information, committee members, if you'd like. Mr. Bodern and Mr. Lundeen, thank you very much for the update. All right. We're going to move along here a little bit before 2. Our last item on the agenda is Mr. Peter Hutchinson, and I'm going to say a few words and how excited I am to have Mr. Hutchinson here. He is the co-founder of the Public Strategies Group, which is a St. Paul company that redesigns and transforms governments throughout the world. Mr. Hutchinson has also served as the Vice President for External Affairs and Chairman of the Dayton Hudson Foundation, Commissioner of Finance for the State of Minnesota, Superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools, and as Deputy Mayor in Minneapolis. In 2006, he was the Independent Party candidate for Minnesota Governor. Hutchinson is co-author with David Osborne, I'm going to give you a plug here, Mr. Hutchinson, of The Price of Government, Getting the Results We Need in an Age of Permanent Fiscal Crisis. He is a graduate of Dartmouth College and Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of International and Public Affairs. Folks, I can tell you that the reason I wanted Mr. Hutchinson to be here is, I don't know, it's probably a month and a half ago, he appeared at our Rotary Club. And as he was making his presentation, I watched my fellow Rotarians, and I saw some with their eyes and their mouths wide open. The information and the data from this study truly was talking points in my community of Waseca for a couple of weeks after the presentation. And I think it's a starting point for us here on this committee to hear and see this presentation. So, Mr. Hutchinson, thank you for taking time out to be here. I know you rushed from a luncheon meeting. I imagine you had escorts through traffic to get here on time, but thank you very much, first of all, for being on time, and the floor is now yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate being here. I apologize in advance for my voice. I've got the winter cold, and I'm battling the cold, and the cold is winning. I'm with the Bush Foundation. I'm lucky enough to be their president, and what I want to share with you is our research that we've been using to help us think about our own priorities. This is indeed the presentation I made in Waseca, because we thought that this information might be helpful to others as you all are thinking about what we call these tough problems. We love Minnesota. There's no reason not to, even this time of year. And the fact is, we got some tough problems. And what our state has always been great at is solving them. And we wanted to what I'd like to describe is what the landscape at least looks like to us. I don't claim this is the only way to look at the landscape. There are many ways to look at it, but it's how we're looking at it. And then maybe end by suggesting a range of options that we all have, including you as leaders of our state, in thinking about what to do about them. So let me just dive right in. the punchline is that we face some really tough problems. We're not going to have the resources now or in the foreseeable future to rely on business as usual strategies to solve them. It's just not going to happen. It doesn't, for me, it's not a question of whether I think this is a good thing or a bad thing. It is a fact. It's a condition that we're not going to easily change. And it's going to take courageous leadership to face up to these tough problems. I just heard the change of power in the Congress, and new Speaker Boehner used that phrase, we can't kick the can down the road. I'm not even sure there's a can left anymore. I'm not going to go through that list. Let me just rifle through these to give you a sense of the scope and scale. The Bush Foundation operates in three states, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So some of these slides deal with three states, but when I can make it just Minnesota, I will. One of the really interesting challenges we've got is that some parts of our state are filling up. They're continuing to fill up, where we think of congestion as kind of the big hassle. But other parts of our state are emptying out, where future viability is really the big challenge. And struggling through how to reconcile the needs of both of those kinds of places is important. And this graph, the dark areas are the ones that continue to explode in population, and the light areas are the ones that are emptying out. We're getting older. By 2020, for the first time in history, old people will be a larger share of the population than school-age kids, for the first time in history. This is uncharted territory. We don't know what this means. I know what it means for me. I'm one of those old people. But what it means for the complexion of our state, the way we think about our future, how we set priorities, this is a very big deal, not only because of this juxtaposition, but mostly because of this one. When we're young, we borrow. We're building up our base of capital and support. I used to think you borrowed to buy a house. Now, of course, you borrow to get student loans. When we're middle-aged, we save. We build up the resources to get us into retirement. And when we get old, we worry. And we're getting old at such an incredible rate in this state. The age, it's not just the age of entitlement, but the age of worriment is very much upon us. And it makes it difficult to imagine all that aggressive energy that us baby boomers had. If we put that same energy into worrying about our futures, it's going to be very complicated. We're going to get more conservative fiscally. We're going to have fewer resources available. As baby boomers retire, they don't pay taxes. The whole fiscal condition of our state changes as we become a state of worry warts. And yet there's an inevitability about these demographic changes. We're also changing in so many profound ways in terms of the makeup of our population. This is one of my favorite pieces of data. My dad's generation, we're from Faribault, Minnesota. We had somewhere between a 1 in 14 and 1 in 25 chance of running into a person of color. For my kids' kids, it's 1 in 3. So that's just in 2.5 generations. That's how rapidly the character of our state is changing. That's a good thing and a challenging thing. It's a good thing because it makes us a more profoundly rich state in terms of perspectives and ideas, but it's also a challenge. Change is a challenge, and it makes it hard for some of us to adjust to things. So this is a reality that we're going to have to face up to. We're sick longer, and we got these chronic disease epidemics going on. I didn't bring this particular chart along, but there's a calculation that was made that if diabetes continues to increase at this rate, it literally by itself will consume most of the healthcare budget. Diabetes is a scourge and an awful condition for people to live with, and it is on a trajectory that if we don't stop, we will pay for. And now if you flip back 3 or 4 slides and remember, we're all getting older. We're older, diabetes, these things are all connected. And so this epidemic we're seeing today is only going to get worse. And, of course, that means that the costs for health care that have been killing us are going to keep killing us. This is my favorite chart. You'll see me refer to this more than once today. This takes the sum total of family budgets. This happens to be national information, but there's no reason to believe that Minnesota is any different. This takes the sum total of family resources and says, where do they go? And if you look to the left-hand side, which is 1970, you can see there was a distribution of the use of family resources and then careen over to the other end. And you see right away what healthcare has been doing, ravaging family budgets, sucking up all of our savings, all of our all the reduced costs for food, which have been a miracle in this country, all of our reduced costs for clothing, every single spare nickel that families have had have gone into health care. And this is at a time, if you're talking from 1970 to 2009 or 10, this is when the baby boomers were earning and saving. These were the good years. Imagine what this graph is going to look like in the next 10 or 20 years. Healthcare costs are literally eating our families alive, not to mention what it's doing to our public sector. The other thing I love about this chart is it adds up to 100%. And I just want you to keep that in mind. They're in 120%, they're in 150%, there's only 100%. So if something on this graph goes up, something else has to go down. It's not one of those rules. And we'll see in just a second why this is so important. If healthcare costs are going to keep rising at these rates, what is it? Now that we've sucked up all the savings, what is it that we're going to give up in order to make it possible? Going forward, 69% of the new jobs are going to be created are going to require some kind of educational accomplishment after high school. 69%. You got to keep that number in your head. 69%. How are we doing in Minnesota right now? Of 100 students that start school in Minnesota, 28% end up with a degree after high school. What's our target? 69. What are we at? 28. Here's the bad news. That wasn't it. We're as good as there is in the country at 28%. It ain't good enough. We can't sustain this economy at that level. In fact, we stand in a position, I believe, this is one of my fears, at this level of performance, which we're very proud of, where for the first time in history, the education system may become a drag on our economy instead of the engine for success. We can't let that happen. We oughtn't let that happen. But if only 50% of our kids start school ready, and only 37% of our kids are proficient in reading at grade 4, and on, only 75% of our kids graduate, only 28% end up with a degree after high school, that system is not helping us, as good as we may think that system is. And if you're a person of color, it's much worse. Much worse. When you start to put these together, our population is becoming more people of color. Our system is not performing already. The odds of it improving unless we make some substantial change, business as usual, cannot get us where we want to go. There's another, I stumbled across this. I wasn't looking for this, but I got to say, this is an unhappy piece of data. The bottom lines are reading scores. These are fourth grade reading scores. This is the NAEP, the National Assessment of Education Progress. So this is not the Minnesota MCA. This is the national assessment. It's the only national assessment we have. It's the only nationwide assessment we have. And this is the raw score. So if you go back to 1975 nationally, we don't have data for Minnesota from back then. The raw score is about 218. And 35 years later, the raw score is 218. So in 35 years, we haven't been able to move fourth grade reading scores at all. Minnesota's the top line. You see, Minnesota's better than the nation. Sadly, Minnesota hasn't been able to move that reading score either. No change. I'll go back to 1975. How much were we spending per child in Minnesota? Just under $6,000 in today's dollars. There's no inflation in here at all. Today's dollars, just under $6,000. What are we spending today? Almost $11,000. But we've increased our financial commitment to our kids by 84% over 35 years, and we haven't changed the reading score 1 point. And let me just remind you, we're among the best in the country. Higher education. 1990, it used to cost about $31,000 for Minscu to produce a degree. This is a real simple calculation. This isn't something real sophisticated. I just took the annual appropriation from the legislature plus the tuition they collected and divided it by the total number of degrees that they awarded. So this isn't some real sophisticated thing. A million people could expert-er this calculation. But using this simple calculation, it used to cost $31,000 in today's dollars, and today it costs $53,000 per degree. That's a lot of dough, a lot of extra dough for the same product. University of Minnesota, interesting pattern, was on this huge upward swing through all of that decade until about 2001, 2002, and all of a sudden their pattern changed. And so today their cost per degree is about the same as it was back in 1990. I think that's something to go look at. I'm fascinated by why that is and what happened. My own theory, by the way, is it was in 2001, 2002, the last recession, the recession when we wrote the book that said the permanent fiscal crisis was here. We didn't know we were a decade too soon, but anyway. What happened is the state reduced its appropriations to the higher education systems, and tuitions really started to skyrocket. And when these institutions had to actually face their students and charge them more dough, they got more efficient. The data would suggest they got a lot more efficient, which is actually not a surprise. But it's a different way to think about the solutions to problems. Government's going to stay broke. This is the Budget Trends Commission. I'm sure you've all thought about this a little bit. We used to collect revenue at a lot higher rate than we will in the future. It's not because of some nefarious decision that somebody made. The economy is going to grow so slowly over the next 20 years that revenues can't grow faster than that. This is not about a change in tax policy. It's a change in the underlying dynamics of our economy. And it has everything to do with all those baby boomers retiring and not being replaced. And I'll show you in a second how that plays out. But the problem with this is that even if revenue can grow at almost 4% a year, healthcare costs are growing so rapidly that there will literally be no additional money left for anything else in government. Nothing. And if you all decided to give education a 2% increase, that means you'd have to literally fund healthcare, education, and cut everything else in order to make it work out. So this is a really tough problem. This is kind of your tough problem, that revenue solutions might be part of the equation, but they are not the answer because there's not enough revenue to fill up that healthcare bucket by itself and keep everything else whole. Now, what about economic growth? Isn't that kind of the way out of this? Well, it ought to be, and it used to be. But remember, economic growth is a function of two things: the number of people working and their productivity. So it's about everybody working and everybody having a good job. Because if everybody's working and they all have a crappy job, that doesn't produce the kind of economic growth we're interested in. So it's everybody working and everybody has a good job. Well, so here's one of the problems. The labor force is going to stop growing. Again, not some nefarious plot. We're just all getting old. And apparently, we didn't have enough kids or grandkids to fuel the labor force. And unless we just, annex another state or, as I like to say, invent a third gender, there's no way to solve this particular challenge. The only solution is productivity. The only solution to get our economy to grow is to get the worker productivity to go up, to skyrocket. Well, what's the history on that? Well, productivity went AWOL in the last 10 years. Minnesota had a really good history of knocking out 2 to 3% productivity growth decade after decade until the last decade, and it basically went to zero. And the big question going forward is, frankly, not about how many jobs we create, but how productive our workforce becomes. Can we get the productivity we need in the workforce to create a growth scenario that will give us better numbers than the ones I just showed you? This is a problem we've got to pay attention to. It's not just about the raw number of human beings that go to work, because there's only so many human beings. It really is about their ability to generate income. And there is no certainty that we can go back to that 2%+ productivity growth. Nobody actually knows. Nobody actually knows why it stalled for the whole last decade, and people are not at all clear about what it's going to take to make it grow in the future. Then, of course, folks don't like us very much. This is a distressing graph about the level of confidence that people have in their leaders. And I don't have all the details for you, but I'd be happy to bring it back, Mr. Chair. We've just commissioned a statewide poll, and so I stuck in the Minnesota state government leaders down there in the lower right-hand corner, just above Congress but below major businesses. This is a tough place. You got tough problems, that's true, but we're also in a tough place in terms of the public's willing to trust that we're capable of pulling it off. So it's a tough deal. There are really serious problems that we need to wrestle with. Money and business as usual solutions aren't going to get us there. So what are the choices that we've got? Well, for a government, there's really four choices. On the one hand, we can tax. We could raise the price of the government we're already getting. That would help some of the fiscal problems go away. On the other hand, we can cut. We can reduce the scope of the government we're already paying for. Now, those words are carefully picked, because if we tax but don't change what we're delivering, we're just raising the price of the good that we're delivering. And if we cut without decreasing the price, we're just delivering less for the money people are already paying. The second one comes home to me every time I go to the grocery store. I love ice cream. But you can't buy a quart of ice cream anymore because they decided to make the container smaller but keep the price the same. And I feel cheated every single time. I still can't get my quart of ice cream. So those are the two choices that have to do with maintaining the status quo. Those are really more or less of the status quo, either paying more for it or getting less for what you're paying. The other two choices are to grow and to redesign. So let me take a couple seconds on each of these just to give you, a sense of the flexibility and scope of possibilities. So first on the tax. So what is the price of government in Minnesota right now? As you know, the Department of Finance actually does track this. In order to get a comparison, though, there's some data available from the U.S. Census, and that's what I've showed you here today. The bottom line is the U.S. as a whole. The top line is Minnesota. Minnesota, big surprise, has been a high-priced state for a really long time. And as you know, the argument has always been made that we were a high-priced state delivering high-quality service. The U.S. has actually been coming up relative to Minnesota, and you know that the rankings recently have shown that Minnesota has actually come down in the national rankings, and that's partly because our price has been held down and partly because everybody else has been coming up. Right now, according to the MMB, we're at about 15.7. That would mean that when you add up all the money received by government in Minnesota, so this is state and local and schools, and it includes taxes and fees and charges and everything, all the dollars that flow into government. The only thing not in here is federal money that comes to Minnesota. And divide it by the income of the state, the income of all of us, it's 15.7% right now. Over the last period here, this is 38 years, the average is about 16.4. So we're a little bit below average at the moment, but close to it. So that's one of the choices. We could raise the price. A second is, and if we do that, by the way, I want to remind you about this chart, because there's still only 100%. So if you decide to raise the price, then you got to be thinking about what our families are going to cut, because there's only 100%. This isn't the federal government. We can only spend the dollars there actually are. And so one of the challenges, I think, that we have and you have in particular is as you wrestle with those choices, families have to wrestle with them too. And somehow this has to get reconciled. And, of course, it will get reconciled for each and every family. The second choice is to cut. That is to actually deliver less for the price that people are paying. These are two-year spending numbers, and again, this is all the money. So this isn't just state government, and it's not just the general fund. It's all funds, again, without federal, state and local. And you can see how $6 billion stacks up against the state only. So the state directly does higher ed and transportation and so on, against local cities and counties that do police and fire and so on, and against schools. I mean, $6 billion is a heck of a lot if you want to sort of take it out the way the ice cream people have done, but leave the price the same. Third choice is growing, and this actually makes a lot of sense from our point of view as a long-term strategy. Tough in the short term. It's hard to imagine, but the recession is over. But clearly it's a slow growth out of this hole, and at some point we will have added back the jobs. But because the labor force levels are so low, we'll get to relatively full employment faster than we would have, say, 20 or 30 years ago. But the real long-term opportunity here is investing in increased productivity. And one of the things we're looking at from the point of view of our foundation is what are the kinds of things we could do there, and we'd encourage you all to be thinking about that same question. And then there's redesign. So how can we get more and better bang for the buck? How can we actually deliver more and better outcomes for the folks? How can we solve these tough problems in ways that produce a better outcome and don't actually allow us to just dwell on how tough the problems are? But to do this, you got to be willing to challenge the status quo. You got to be focusing on new solutions, not just improving on old ones. You got to be looking for huge productivity increases, 15, 20, 25%. You really got to think, and you got to challenge kind of everything that's out there. Let me give you this one example from my days as a school superintendent. When I took over the Minneapolis schools, one of the places I wandered into was the Central Distribution Center, which is in a school district, if you're a teacher and you need a globe or a map or a bulletin board, you send a requisition to Central Distribution, and somebody in Central Distribution gets it for you. So I was visiting schools, and I was constantly hearing about the problems, that they'd ask for a map, and they'd get a globe, and they'd ask for a bulletin board, and they'd get paper, or they'd get a globe that didn't have all the right countries on it, or, you know, it was 40 years old or whatever. It was just terrible. And so I decided I should go to the distribution center and see what was going on. And I wandered in, and I said, "How do you like working here?" And everybody said, "We hate it." I said, "Well, what do you hate about it?" And they said, "Well, every time we deliver this stuff to the schools, they yell at us." So that must be because you're delivering the stuff, you know, 2 weeks after they wanted it, and then it's the wrong stuff. And they said, "Yeah, this place sucks. We don't like working here." Perfect situation, right? And so the question for a school superintendent is, what are you going to do about that? And now, trust me, I know nothing about distribution or globes or maps or bulletin boards or anything else, nor do I know anything about running such an operation. So I was trying to figure out how could I get this piece of work changed in a way that would fundamentally improve outcomes for our kids. And I hit upon the following strategy, and this is actually what we did. We said to the folks in the distribution center, next year we're going to take the money appropriated to run the distribution service and we're going to give it to the schools. We're going to say to the schools, you can buy your resources wherever you want. You can buy them from Office Depot, you can buy them from Target, but you can buy them from the central distribution shop. Now, we said to the distribution people, that's pretty scary. So we're going to give you a year to prepare for this, and we're going to invest in your ability to get better, because we actually want you to succeed at this, but we're not telling the schools they have to buy their stuff from you. So without telling you the whole nasty story, 1 year later, turnaround time was down to 24 hours. If you called in and said you wanted a globe, you got a globe within 24 hours, and it had all the countries on it. And I went back to the warehouse and got the gang together. I said, "So what'd you do?" And they said, "Well, we did everything. We took the whole place apart. We did some radical stuff. Like, we put the things that people ask for most in the front." And we found out we had $3 million worth of inventory that we had ordered that no one ever wanted. So we sold all of that, and we took the $3 million and reinvested it in the technology to make the place work better. And on and on and on. I said, "Well, how do you like working here now?" And they said, "I got to tell you, we have never worked harder in our lives. We're busting our asses night and day to get this stuff out, and we love it." I said, "Well, why do you love it?" "Because when we deliver stuff to the schools, they say thank you." That's redesign. See, the beauty of that is I didn't have to know what the design was. I don't know what the right design is. What I had to do is create the conditions under which the people responsible could figure it out, because they were plenty smart. And they did a terrific job, as you can tell. In fact, it was so good, and they did so well, that they actually provided a financial rebate to the schools at the end of the year. Little customer appreciation deal. So what we learned from that experience is there are some pretty straight-up levers that you all can use if you want to get operations redesigned, seriously redesigned. Consequences is one of them. I mean, these folks knew that those schools could go buy their stuff someplace else. That's an important consequence. It's an incentive to think differently. Giving people choice and providing for competition, that helps. That gets people spurred to think, "Oh, I better go find out how the competition does it, see if I can beat them." Giving the customers power. When the schools realized that the distribution center was actually on their side, it was huge. It changed everything. Control, right? We didn't tell people how to do things. We gave them a lot of flexibility, but they had absolute accountability for delivery. Because if they didn't deliver, they were going to lose that opportunity. targeting resources, consolidating things turned out to be very powerful. And one that we don't often think about as a redesign lever is the use of community to produce better outcomes, the power of communities to get things done. My favorite example is, because I've lived long enough, is there used to be a time when we had a lot of trash on our roads. I mean, a lot of trash on our roads and no sign saying this is my piece of road to pick up. And that's using community. When we let people actually have the responsibility to clean up the crap on the side of the roads but put their name there saying they're going to be part of a community that cares, we changed our roads. Well, community is a really powerful thing if we think about how to harness it, and often we don't. So I think one of the opportunities that you all have is to think about how to use these levers to create the conditions in which redesign becomes the way we do things. Because neither you nor we are smart enough to dream up all the solutions. But there's a gazillion smart people in Minnesota. What they're looking for are the kinds of conditions under which redesign becomes more normal. And there are really three things that I think this story illustrates that you can do. First, how do you do the budget? Now, I used to do the budget, so I have a lot of sympathy for the challenge here. But, you know, most of what we do in the budget is we pay for the status quo plus or minus. And we don't actually get real hung up about getting the results we need, because if we were hung up, some of those graphs I showed you wouldn't look like that. So one thing is to think about the approach to budgeting. And there's a whole approach called budgeting for outcomes, which really puts the onus on the proposers to deliver results for whatever amount of money you choose to spend. So that's one thing you can look at. Another thing are all the administrative systems. Personnel, purchasing, accounting, audit, you know, all of these systems have cooked into them a bunch of assumptions about the status quo and the way it's always been and the way we're always going to do it. And if you don't mess around with some of those assumptions, it's really hard to get a different outcome. The classic, when I became finance commissioner, we had a budget shortfall, and my job was to help figure out how to get out of it. And, of course, I tried doing it the traditional way, which was I was going to be smarter than everybody else. And as I proved time and time again in my life, I'm not smarter than anybody else. And then somebody who was really smart, a union member, actually said to me, "You don't understand how the hell the budget works," and he was absolutely right. And he told me this terrible story about if they and their shop saved any money, the people at MMB would come and take it away. And to just kick them in the ass one last time, they'd say, "If you didn't need the money this year, we'll cut your budget next year too." Well, what kind of incentive is that? And that's cooked into the system. So we got to ask ourselves, are the systems actually getting us the kind of results that we want? And then finally, you got to invest. You know, redesign is a really little word for a lot of work. And, you know, those people in that distribution center, they had to take the place apart and put it back together. And if we hadn't invested in that, it never would have happened. That doesn't mean we told them how to do it, but we made sure that they were put in a position to deliver the kind of fabulous result that we were looking for. And you actually can do this. You can actually invest. You can, I mean, literally invest. Like put money into something and expect to get paid back so you can invest in something else. I'm not using invest the way it's often used as code for spend. I'm talking about invest in the way it used to be used, which you actually get a return. And it's possible, I think, for all of us, and we're thinking about this at the Bush Foundation, to not give money away, but to actually invest in change with the expectation that we're going to get paid back, and we'll then invest in some more change. This is another one of these opportunities I think you all have to at least think about. For our part of the deal, here's three things we have going on that I'll just give you early warnings on, and Mr. Chairman, if it makes sense, I'd be happy to come back and share the results. We've just finished with our partners in the Citizens League and Take Action Minnesota a series of meetings around the state in communities all over Minnesota to talk about this information. It's part of why I was in Waseca. We're asking citizens to grapple with these same tough questions and give us their 2 cents worth. And sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to be ready to report on that. As I mentioned, we've just finished a statewide poll that actually explores some of these same questions, and we'll be happy to share all that information with you as well. We've been in the process since 2009 of trying to generate redesign ideas, so not proposals, but possibilities, with our partners in 4 other foundations, the St. Paul Foundation, the Minnesota Foundation, the Northwest Area Foundation, and the Blandin Foundation. In 2009, we created this thing called Minnesota's Bottom Line, and we'll be back to you in a couple weeks with Bottom Line 2, which is another collection or an expanded collection of ideas. Again, not proposals, but thoughts. Also, I understand you're going to hear from the Commission on Service Innovation. I had the privilege of serving on that group as well. They've got some ideas for you to look at. And finally, we're interested in investing in your development as leaders, because doing redesign work, doing innovation, is not something that everybody was trained and prepared and ready to do. It requires a different kind of thinking. And if you all have an interest, if your colleagues have an interest in pursuing a leadership development opportunity as part of this process, we'd be happy to be your partners in that. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hutchinson. It was truly nice to see again. It's very interesting. I'm staying on time. There's no further business before this committee. We are right now adjourned. For the members, if you'd like to ask Mr. Hutchinson any questions, he's going to stick around for a while.
May we leave things in there?
By the way, if you want to leave your folders, we'd appreciate that. It will help us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. If you leave items in your folders, it